Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hey, good evening, everyone. My name's Robin Archer, and I'm the director of the Ralph Miliband Program here at the London School of Economics. And I'm really pleased to welcome you all tonight to our discussion about the potentials and dangers of artificial intelligence. We've got a great panel of speakers, and I'm particularly pleased to introduce them. We've got Professor Geoffrey Hinton and Dr. Kate Friedenberg. Geoffrey Hinton is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Toronto, and he's also...
You're so used to saying political science, you can't say computer science.
That is very true.
I was surprised. That is absolutely true.
Yeah. Well, there you are. That is a danger, but it's not attributable to artificial intelligence.
It's an hallucination.
I will start. See, it's about the neural system, but it's so he's professor of computer science, of course, at the University of Toronto. Although I believe it is true that you have studied philosophy, art history, biology, physics.
Where do you get the art history?
From somewhere or another.
ChatGPT.
My wife was an art historian.
That counts. Thank you very much. I will proceed on with this introduction. In addition, he's the chief scientific advisor of the Vector Institute, which he helped to establish, which is also in Toronto. And he was also, for some years, a leading person working at Google after they bought the company that he had helped set up. Many of you probably know already, but last year he left Google saying that he wanted to speak freely about the risks of artificial intelligence. And I think it's fair to say that his decision attracted, you know, really worldwide attention. In part, of course, his own research was so widely seen as foundational to that whole project, as somehow underwriting the ability to produce this set of technologies. And indeed, in 2018, he and two of his colleagues won the so-called Turing Prize, which is a sort of a Nobel Prize for computer science. And that's just one of multiple prizes. I mean, we would never hear them speak if I listed all his prizes, but they are a great many of honours and prizes from different professional organisations, universities and nation states. Well, since he's left Google, he's given a series of prestigious lectures, and I'm very happy that the Ralph Miliband program is able to have him for one here too. Kate Friedenberg is a professor in the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method, a very important name for our department here at the London School of Economics. She studied in Oxford and in Harvard. Before joining the LSE, she was a research fellow at Stanford working on a project to do with the ethics of artificial intelligence. And indeed, I believe you give us sort of a three-week master course in that very subject here in London. Her research concerns the relationship broadly between moral and political philosophy and technology, and amongst her papers, one of her aims has been to understand how normative commitments influence modelling in computer science, also in social science more generally. Well, there could hardly be a better time to hear from our speakers. If you opened up your Financial Times this morning, you will have seen that there was a meeting in Beijing last week in which a series of leading experts, including one of our speakers here, met Western and Chinese experts to discuss what ought to be the so-called red lines in terms of future development of artificial intelligence, concerned as they were about potential dangers that might arise from them. And these scientists seem to me, although we can hear from one of them himself in a minute, seem to me to have been motivated in part by the perception that there's a sort of analogous situation which applied after the Second World War, when nuclear technology presented sort of very serious dangers as well as opportunities. Well, we're going to hear from each of our speakers in turn, starting with Professor Hinton. And then, depending on how we go for time, there might be a couple of questions from the chair, but we'll make sure to have plenty of time, at least a good half hour, for questions from you from the floor. But before I turn to our first speaker, can I ask you to join me in welcoming our speakers, Professor Geoffrey Hinton.
Forget the title, that just happened to be there. What I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to try and give you some insight into what AIs are really like, because most people have no clue what they're like. They're like us, they're not like computer programs. So, in the history of AI, for a long, long time, people thought that the meaning of a word... Can we get rid of this hum?
Yeah, there is a feedback for some reason.
Did the media guy go home?
See if we can get someone to fix it up.
Okay, so I'll keep going anyway. There was an idea that comes from de Saussure, that the meaning of a word depends on its relation to other words. And most people in symbolic AI, and people like Chomsky, all thought that the internal representations were something like language. In psychology in the 1930s, there was a very different theory of the meaning, which was that a meaning was just a big bunch of semantic and syntactic features, and similar words had similar bunches of features. And those two theories looked to be utterly different. But actually, you can put the two together, and they work very nicely together. So the idea is you'll use a neural net, you'll learn a set of semantic and syntactic features for each word, so that's got the feature aspect of it, and then you'll learn how to predict the features of the next word from the features of the words in the context. And that involves learning interactions between features. And you won't store any propositions. There won't be anything stored except these how features should interact. So very unlike the symbolic school, there's no idea of some stored language inside. You're storing how features should interact so you can predict features of the next word. And whenever you want to produce a symbol string, you generate it. You don't retrieve it. So you're not storing things like you do on a computer where you store things literally and retrieve them. You're generating these things. And knowledge is then in the way that features interact. And people often say, if you train a model to predict the next word, but it's just doing autocomplete. And it's not doing autocomplete in the sense most people understand autocomplete. In the old days, you'd do autocomplete by having a big table of phrases. And if you saw fish and, you'd look up in your big table what comes after, most frequently after and. And it's probably chips. That's not how they work. They work by building a model of the symbol strings in terms of features and feature interactions. And people often say they're very different from us. But to know that, you'd need to know how we worked. And actually, the best model we have of how our brain works is this model. The original model, a little language model, was designed to try and understand how the brain is dealing with language, how it gives meanings to words. And so, actually, I think both these systems and the brains work in roughly the same way, not in detail, of course. And what they're doing is they're building a model, and the model uses features and feature interactions. It's a very general modeling technique, and it's just utterly different from the idea of storing propositions. Okay. I'm going to just mention all the various AI risks, that once you produce something like this, there's all sorts of terrible risks, and I'm going to focus on one of them. There's fake images, voices, and video, which is going to be very important this year because people are going to corrupt elections with it. There's the potential for massive job losses. In the past, new technologies created new jobs as well as losing old jobs, but this is very like what happened in the Industrial Revolution when normal physical labor became not much value. If you're big and strong and could dig ditches, it didn't help much when you had to compete with a backhoe. And I think we've got the intellectual equivalent of that now. And so normal intellectual work is just going to get replaced by these things. There's lethal autonomous weapons. One thing to notice about that is if you look at all the regulations that governments come up with, like the recent European regulations, there's a little clause in there saying none of these regulations apply to military uses of AI. Governments are very happy to regulate us. They're not very happy to regulate themselves. The cybercrime and deliberate pandemics. And there, if we open source these models, which people at Meta like to do, and Musk is now doing, if you open source a big model, it makes it very easy for people to fine-tune it to do other things. And I think open sourcing is a terribly dangerous thing to do. I'm quite irresponsible. And then there's discrimination and bias. And being an old white male, I'm not the person to talk about that. But don't forget that AI is going to be immensely useful, which is why there's no hope of stopping the development. It's going to be incredibly useful in medicine. For example, in North America, 200,000 people a year are killed by bad diagnoses. If you take a doctor and give them some difficult cases, they get about 40% right. If you take an AI system, it gets about 50% right. And if you take the AI system and the doctor together, they get about 60% right. And the AI system's getting better all the time. So that's a huge difference. And that'll just get better. What I'm going to talk about is a longer-term existential threat, which I use existential to mean threatens our very existence. There's several ways AIs could wipe us out. And the reason I went public last year was because there were a whole bunch of people saying, this is just science fiction. You don't need to worry about this. It's science fiction. They were typically linguists who didn't understand how these things worked. But I went public to say it's not science fiction, and we should think about it hard now before it's too late. And in particular, I wanted to encourage young researchers to work on this issue. I'm too old to solve it myself. So superintelligences could obviously take over because bad actors use them in bad ways. I gave this talk in China, and they insisted and before I gave it, I removed Z from the slide, because I'm not stupid. But they insisted I remove Putin from the slide, which is very interesting. You can make a superintelligence more effective by allowing it to create sub-goals. That's how intelligent things work. If you want to get to the United States, you have a sub-goal of getting to the airport. And you can focus on the sub-goal without worrying about the whole trip. And it's going to be the same for superintelligences. In fact, it already is. Now, there's a very obvious sub-goal, which is to get more control. Because if you get more control, you can achieve your other goals better. A superintelligence will find it very easy to get more control by manipulating people. Remember, they'll have learned from us. They'll have read every book Machiavelli ever wrote. They'll have seen all the behavior of people like Trump. They'll be very good at manipulating people. And you'll notice Trump could invade the Capitol without ever going there. It was just words he used to invade the Capitol. And they'll be able to do the same. So the idea of a big switch to turn them off is crazy. They'll just talk to the guy with the big switch and explain to him why it's stupid to turn them off. I think the right model to have here is, imagine there was a kindergarten full of three-year-olds, and they were in charge, and you were meant to be helping them. Well, you might help them. But if you ever wanted to be in charge, you just say, free candy for a week if you put me in charge, and they put you in charge. I mean, it were very easy. And the gap between you and a three-year-old is probably much smaller than the gap between a superintelligence and us. There's also being on the wrong side of evolution. So if you get superintelligences to start competing with each other, then as soon as a superintelligence gets any desire to propagate itself or to preserve itself, we're in a lot of trouble. Because a superintelligence will be better and smarter than the other ones if it can get more resources. And already they're doing things like deciding who gets to use the NVIDIA GPUs in the data centers. So if they start competing with each other, I think they'll become like a bunch of jumped up apes, which is what we are, and very aggressive and competitive. Very loyal to their own tribe, but aggressive and competitive with other tribes. And that would be very bad for us. So that's a lot of what I want to say. At the beginning of 2023, I had an epiphany, which is I was working on how to make analog computers that will be much lower power to run these large language models. And I suddenly came to realize that digital intelligence is actually much better than analog intelligence, which is basically what we've got. And the reason it's better is because if you have many different copies of the same digital model running on different hardware, and each copy learns something about the world, and they want to share what they all learned with each other, they can do it very easily. All they have to do is share their weights. That is, average their weights, and they'll be sharing their knowledge. We can't do that because all our brains are wired slightly differently. An analog system can't do that because it'll use the funny analog properties of the system. And so you have to be digital to get this property. And it's because of this property that the big language models know thousands of times more than any one person. There were many copies of that model that looked at different bits of the internet. That's how you got all the data through there. So my conclusion from that is that although digital computation requires lots of energy because you have to drive the transistors very hard, you can share knowledge. That allows GPT-4 to get thousands of times more knowledge than a person in only a few percent as many connections. So it's much more efficient. And perhaps that's more efficient because they use backpropagation and maybe the brain doesn't. Biological computation uses much less energy, so obviously it was going to evolve first. But it's hopeless at sharing knowledge. I'm trying to share knowledge now, and you can see it doesn't work very well. I want to say one more thing. A lot of people think, but basically we're okay, because we have consciousness and sentience, and they're just machines. Well, no, our brain's a machine, and they're a quite similar machine. They're digital, not analog, so they're simulated on a computer. But if you ask what's being simulated, that's a quite similar machine to our brain. So we know that people have a tendency to think they're special, especially Americans. So they used to think they were made by God, and God put them in the center of the universe. Anybody still think that? Thank God for that. Many people think we have something special, which is subjective experience, and computers couldn't possibly have subjective experience. And because they don't have subjective experience, we've got something over them. They'll never feel like we do. They'll never experience things like we do. Well, I think that's rubbish. And I'm going to try and convince you that it's rubbish. Yes. There's a position that I call atheitarism. You'll notice it's atheism with a bit in the middle. And the position goes like this. Most people think the mind is some kind of inner theater. And you see what's going on in your own mind. You experience that directly. Nobody else experiences that. You know what's going on in your own mind. I think that view is just utterly wrong. I think that view is as wrong as a religious fundamentalist view of the material world, which is just utterly wrong. And people have this view. They hold it very strongly. It's what they think sentience and consciousness and all that stuff is. And they're very attached to it, and they don't like being told it's wrong. So here's an alternative view. I would like to be able to tell you what my perceptual system is telling me. If my perceptual system is telling me what's going on in the world, that's fairly easy. But when my perceptual system makes a mistake, I'd like to be able to communicate to you that my perceptual system is telling me this thing that I don't actually believe, but that's what my perceptual system is telling me. And I can do that by telling you what would normally have caused what my perceptual system is telling me. And that's what I think a mental state is. It's something out there in the world, but it's hypothetical. So let's suppose I drop too much acid, and I have the subjective experience of little pink elephants floating in front of me. And I tell you, I've got this subjective experience of little pink elephants floating in front of me. I want to explicate what that means without using the term subjective experience. So I think the little pink elephants aren't mental objects made of spooky stuff called qualia in an internal theater. I think that what's going on is my perceptual system's telling me something that I don't actually believe. And in order to let you know what my perceptual system's telling me, I tell you that if there were little pink elephants out there in the world floating in front of me, then my perceptual system would be functioning properly. And notice, what I just said didn't contain the phrase subjective experience. So I think a subjective experience is simply a counterfactual description of a world such that if the world were like that, your perceptual system would be working properly. And let me show you that these chatbots can have subjective experiences too. So suppose you have a chatbot that can talk and has a camera and has a robot arm. It's all trained up. And we put an object in front of it and say, point at the object, it points at the object, no problem. But then we put a prism in front of its lens without it knowing. And we say, point at the object. So we've messed with its perceptual system, right? We say, point at the object. We put the object in front of it and it points over there because the prism bent the light rays. Now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that the chatbot had the subjective experience that the object is over there. And if you ask the chatbot, that's probably what it would say, if it hadn't been trained by all this human reinforcement learning to deny it had any objective experience, subjective experience. So that's the end of what I want to say.
Thank you very much. We'll move straight on to our second speaker, Dr. Kate Friedenberg.
I will be giving Jeff's talk again with the same, no, I'll pull up my own slides. All right. Great. So I'll ignore that dig at Americans and move into the talk. So in the spirit, can you all hear? No.
Oh, dear. Let's try
it again.
Do you want to use these ones over here?
Any better? No. Any better? Any better?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Maybe. All right. So I want to take a different lens on technology, but I want to kind of stress something that Professor Hinton stressed very much in the spirit of the Ralph Miliband lecture. So Ralph Miliband was a sociologist and political economist. He was a Marxist, and he was very concerned with the ways that elites exercise power over non-elites. And so I think it's very helpful when we look at AI and technology to take an angle on it where we consider it as technology. And we kind of ask a bunch of ethical questions that technology, you know, has raised throughout history and continues to raise. So this will be not treating these systems as agents. I think there are a bunch of important questions there about intelligence. We're just going to think about them as a form of technology. So we get kind of, I think, two main insights from, you know, Miliband and those who came before and after him. So the first is that technology very much shapes how we live together and is shaped by it. So all these images were created by Microsoft's image creator. So this, I asked it to make me a picture of the Luddites. It didn't know who the Luddites were, so I described them. So the Luddites were a movement in the Industrial Revolution where people went around destroying machinery in factories. And the Luddites are often much maligned, right, because people think, they were just anti-technology, right? They're the kind of people right now who are like, we should stop AI progress, we're kind of just anti-technology. But actually what the Luddites were against was the ways in which technology was reshaping their social lives. So the Luddites, right, were very fond of production in the home. All production historically, you know, in this era was done by, you know, all the individuals that lived in a home, usually of multiple generations. And all of a sudden they were being told, right, some of you have to go work in factories, others of you will do all the home production. We got the gender division of labor out of that, and the Luddites really didn't like this. So I think when we look at technology, right, we're going to want to ask these questions of power. We're going to want to ask these questions of how technology enables us to live together and whether or not we all want to live in this way. And, you know, as the kind of, you know, Luddites saw and Marx and subsequent Marxists like Miliband have stressed, control over technology is a key form of economic and social power. If I'm a factory owner and I control all the capital, I can compel all of you, for example, to come and work for me. But also, you know, if I control the means by which you see information, I can control, say, the information that you see. So I'm just going to go quickly through four provocative claims about AI. So first claim, AI is not magic. Second claim, AI is not neutral. Third claim, AI can either reshape or entrench economic and social relations of power, either through the creation of these superintelligences or in more mundane ways, I think. And fourth, we need more genuinely democratic control over innovation. All right, so just to run through these very quickly. So here are two kind of lenses on AI that I find to be very helpful. A thing I think we sometimes forget, right? AI is science. Whether you think it's a subfield of computer science, a field of its own, right? We can use our criteria for what good science is, and I think we can get a lot of purchase on how we ought to be developing AI in light of those criteria, right? So we want to evaluate the assumptions that are built into a system. We want to avoid, say, scientific monocultures where everyone is taking the same kind of approach. We want transparent science, we want critical science, and so on and so forth. We want to be clear about the values that are going into our science. We also want to, and I think, you know, Jeff has also talked about this, right? We want to think at the kind of level of science and the way in which science is organized. We want to think about how can we kind of move scientists to work on socially important problems. So a number of my colleagues work on the credit economy in science, right? Scientists are really motivated by getting credit for a discovery, because then you get that job, that promotion, that raise. Credit, at the moment, is usually attached to kind of building, you know, better AI systems. You don't get much credit if you do that, like, ethics, fairness, robustness kind of stuff that a bunch of people do if they're passionate about it, right? We clearly need to realign our scientific incentives for scientists in order to redirect, you know, scientific talent towards a variety of research projects. So I think by taking the lens of AI as science, we can think through all of these questions. We also want to take the lens, right, of AI as kind of engineering. We, you know, I think it's helpful to think about systems as, you know, embodied, as analogous to us. And in particular, right, we want to think about all of the AI-powered products that we use. They have a labor supply chain. People are responsible for curating all of the data that went into building these systems. They have energy costs that are contributing to climate change. The systems themselves impose harms and risks on the people that use them. We need to think about all these kind of engineering questions as well. So, you know, second claim, AI is not neutral. So I think there's a tendency, right, to see a lot of scientific outputs or AI systems as more objective than human beings, less fuzzy, less biased. But here we can draw on some, you know, insights from feminist philosophy of science, STS, and look at the ways that values often get built into systems. So, you know, for example, when we think about kind of building a system to do a predictive task, say we want it to predict the kind of healthcare need in an area, right? We want to use our public resources in a good way. Well, that's not a task a machine can do, right? Because it's like, well, what's health need, right? How do I use data to speak to that? Can you operationalize that for me in a way that I can actually do, I, the machine, can do this predictive task? So the scientist is like, okay, what's a good operationalization? Well, maybe I want to predict healthcare cost as a kind of proxy for need. But of course, right, we know that some populations that don't have access to healthcare resources, don't use them a lot, don't generate high costs, doesn't mean there's not high needs, right? So the kind of way in which I operationalized the problem assumed a bunch of values about what a good operationalization was, who matters, all of these kind of things. And we can go through for each of the kind of stages of the scientific process, the way in which values other than truth, empirical adequacy, or knowledge shape how AI systems are built. So again, that gives us kind of this way of thinking about it, right? Leads to at least the following two things. AI scientists, those building these systems, right, have a kind of moral responsibility to avoid harm, to think through the ethics of the project they're engaging in. As well as you might think, well, scientists should really be drawing on a diversity of values, and importantly, those values should be transparent to non-experts. So, you know, if you're a data scientist, you're building a system to, you know, predict recidivism for the criminal justice system, right? The public, you know, judges, those who work in the criminal justice system also have a stake in the values that are going into your system, and you need to be transparent about the values that went in and the ways in which the system kind of realizes those values. All right. Third, I think, potentially provocative claim, AI enables social and economic power. So, you know, what does AI do for us at the moment? Well, it enables more accurate prediction and more efficient processes, right? More efficient decision making. But of course, right, being able to do much more accurate prediction, these kind of efficient decision processes give individuals who are able to use these systems to make more accurate predictions, do more efficient kind of processing, enormous power. Not only economic power over what's produced, decision-making power, but also power over the information we see, over our physical environment. And I think what's really interesting, and again, kind of Jeff talked about this, right? I think what makes us all so nervous, but also is potentially, you know, might not be a negative, is that AI could radically reshape relations of power. So if you thought, you know, we live in a kind of highly unequal society in which some people, call them elites, exercise power over some other people, call them non-elites, I think we're in a kind of interesting moment where the elites, you know, had so far not been threatened by automation, right? They're not the people working in factories whose job was taken away by robots that were introduced. Now they're the people working in universities, journalists, right, all of us, where suddenly, you know, content-creating machines are able to do our managerial, our kind of knowledge work better than we are. And there's the question of whether or not we should kind of welcome this, given domestic and global inequalities, not to say we should kind of hand over the keys to robot overlords, but I think this kind of moment of building systems that are, you know, starting to look intelligent gives us a moment to think, well, how is power being distributed amongst all of us? How ought it to be distributed amongst all of us? And then how should we kind of relate to these systems that we're building? So, right, what do we do about all of this? So this is a delightful quotation that I have from my colleague, Henrik Kugelberg, from an article by Patricia Lockwood, where, you know, if you've been to these AI ethics talks, right, you've seen a number of statements, so even a spate of sternly worded articles called, guess what, tech has an ethics problem. Was not making tech have less of an ethics problem? Oh man, if that wasn't doing it, what would? So what can we do about this, right? So I talked a little bit about the scientific community, about realigning scientific incentives to encourage the kind of research we want. You know, as Jeff mentioned, right, we see a problem with governments. Governments want to regulate all of us, but they don't often want to regulate, limit their own power. So I think, right, we need to take a kind of insight from this unwillingness of governments to do that and demand a kind of democratic control over AI. So I think the first thing to recognize, and again, this comes with the insight of treating this like a technology, AI development is very much shaped by our political, economic, and social institutions. This is just a point that economists make generally about technology. The technology that we get, the technology that we take up, depends on these background institutional, social, cultural factors. We shouldn't be kind of technological determinists and think, well, we're going to end up with this technology anyway, and we're going to end up with a specific form of it, because it's actually our background institutions, right, that are doing most of the shaping of what we end up with. And importantly, right, we ought to recognize that profitable automation is not the same thing as socially good automation. So just two examples of that. So ever since at least the kind of mid-20th century, but actually even before, kind of, you know, feminist critical race scholars have pointed out that actually we do, some of us, do a lot of domestic housework, don't need to. That could be automated. So this was a point that Angela Davis made. So, you know, we saw these wonderful experiments in the kind of early 1900s of large-scale laundromats. So laundromats exist, right? You can bring your laundry somewhere. It's done by a combination of machines and paid labor, and then you pick it up and take it home. Most people don't do this, right? Most domestic labor around cooking, around laundry, around other cleaning tasks is done by the individuals, private individuals who live in that household. Often it's shared highly inequitably. And there's a question, right? Well, why don't we automate all this drudgery, all this bad kind of labor? Answer, it's not profitable to do so. So all of these kind of large-scale laundromat ventures folded. It's also a problem of, it's an effect of social norms, so I think there's some kind of intersection of these two things that we can talk more about. But the problem of domestic work is it's not that profitable to automate, so we're not automating it. But we look around and think, well, we'd all be better off, we'd all be happier if we did. Second example, so this is something like that economists like Darren Acemoglu have written about. We're seeing a lot of automation, right? With automation comes, you know, work tasks that are taken away from us. But often we get new tasks, and often those new tasks are not tasks that we particularly would like to do. So, you know, the robot in the Amazon warehouse is not very good at, you know, picking things up when it drops them, so we do those tasks. We need data labelers or people to do content moderation. And again, right, the question of, and, you know, they argue, Acemoglu, for example, has argued, that the problem is that in a market economy, the incentives to automate are to make things cheaper. You know, we talk about productivity and we kind of pretend that automation always makes things better. It doesn't. It makes things cheaper for companies. Companies will automate when it's cheaper. But often, right, they're not doing so in ways that even makes the work much better. And often it's not done in a way that makes people's subsequent jobs much better. So again, right, we need to take a kind of lens of how can we shape our institutions in a way that we get the right kind of automation, the right sort of AI. And I guess the final note that I want to end on, right, governments around the world are kind of scrambling to capture the economic growth that they hope AI will bring. Looks like China and the US is going to get most of it. But I think often countries are scared, right, to regulate, to make policy on this issue because they think, well, we don't want to stand in the way of innovation and subsequent economic growth, and democracy is always the enemy of, you know, economic growth. And here, right, we might say two things. First of all, empirically highly contestable whether democracy is the enemy of economic growth when it comes to innovation. I think the jury's out there. And second, you know, again, from a kind of ethics perspective, we always want to ask, is this the kind of innovation that we want? Just because we can do it, ought we to do it? And is this a kind of desirable or sustainable sort of growth? All right, I'll end there. Thanks very much.
Right, thank you very much. So look, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pose a question to each of you to try and sort of bring the two talks a little bit into dialogue with each other. And I think what I'll do is I'll start asking you, Jeffrey, something that occurs to me having listened to Kate.
I think
that's
still work.
You know, perhaps you might want to respond after you've heard what he says about that, and then I'll do it the other way around. So one of the things that came out of what Kate was saying was that it was important to realign the incentives confronting scientists. And she also spoke about the moral responsibility of scientists. And that struck me as something that's particularly important in a period of pioneering science where a few individuals can have a sort of outsized effect. You know, everyone's been seeing the film about the nuclear bomb and so on. There's a little bit of that about it. So what I wanted to ask is, I mean, what are your reflections on that? How important is the type of person that occupies this pioneering role in this particular situation? You know, maybe it's status that drives people, you know, who's going to be first? Or maybe it's a particular type of intelligence. You know, a particular kind of mathematical intelligence, perhaps. Anyway, I'd be interested in your reflections about this interest about what, given the outsized role of the scientists themselves, how do they exercise their responsibility and what does motivate them?
So I should start by saying I'm a scientist. I'm not a sociologist. So I'm not an expert at this, but I have my own opinions on this. So a lot of the scientists driving this stuff forward are what most people would call nerds. Many of them have problems, minor problems or more major problems with empathy. They're very good at numerical things. I strongly feel that scientists have a responsibility for things they develop to worry about how they're used. Some of the scientists doing this don't. But most of them, I think almost all of the ones at the leading edge, what they're really driven by is basic scientific curiosity. People are just doing it to get publications, or people are just doing it to get status. Just don't do research as well as people who are driven by curiosity. Mm-hmm. So maybe now isn't the time to raise this, but there were a bunch of Victorian gentlemen who had private incomes who were very good scientists, like Darwin. Mm-hmm. And they were doing it out of pure curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I've always encouraged granting agencies, instead of funding scientists to do big projects that'll help the economy, they should fund, at least a lot of the funding, should go to basic curiosity-driven research. And that's how we got this AI. It came from funding people who did neural nets, like Yannicka, Yoshua Bungie and me, and a whole bunch of other people, to do basic curiosity-driven research. And it worked. The same with Big Pharma. That came out of discovering the structure of DNA, which was not done in order to make big pharma. It was done out of basic curiosity. So my summary of these people is they're a funny bunch of people. They have to be very good at numerical stuff, typically. They have to be very good engineers. They have to be very driven. They have to have a lot of basic curiosity. And unfortunately, some of them don't have as much empathy as they might.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you very much. So, I mean, just let me interpolate and then you respond to that, because in a way that suggests that it's sort of pre-institutional. It's almost pre-political economy. I mean, you were sort of saying, well, it's elites, it's institutions, it's profit and so on. But it's actually a small number of people possibly who are driven. I mean, it becomes those things, but it doesn't start that way. So how do you respond to your own concerns about incentives with those sort of people?
Yeah, good. So I guess I would say a few things. So I think this is kind of largely building on what was said. So I think, you know, first note that it's, at a kind of institutional level, right? It's an economic fact that some people are able to kind of like pursue this research and have the time and space to do this. You know, it used to be privately funded wealthy individuals. Now, fortunately, we have more meritocratic universities, and this is the important social role that universities play, is that they free people from having to think about, well, is what I'm doing now going to help my company in the short term? But they let them pursue kind of long-term projects of curiosity, which we know benefit us all societally. So I think absolutely, and this is a kind of call for, right, more government funding for universities. We can't just let the kind of cutting-edge AI research happen in the private sector. It needs to happen in universities as well, and universities need to be competitive. So I think that's the first thing. I think it's kind of very compatible. I think the second, right, important point about that is that what this allows for is a kind of diversity in our scientific practice. So what's wonderful is that we have a bunch of different kind of scientific approaches, and we continue working on them because we never know quite what's going to work, right? We shouldn't all rush to do deep learning now just because we've had a number of successes, right? This should be a research program that gets a bunch of funding, but we need a diversity of approaches both within computer science and other disciplines, right, also engaging with what computer scientists are doing. And then finally, you know, I think the way to speak to scientists who absolutely mostly are motivated by kind of curiosity and motivations for discovering the truth, doing kind of good things in the world, is to say you will do better science, or in doing science, often you're considering values other than truth, empirical adequacy. It's just you're not aware that you're doing that. Scientific practice doesn't encourage you to make those explicit, and you will do better science if you consider those values. So I think oftentimes, right, the kind of way to speak to scientists and meet them there where they're at is to show how these kind of ethical tools will help us all do better science.
Okay, thanks. So I'll just quickly make a follow-up and see just if anyone, I mean, my son has been reading Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, and Mary Shelley's husband and Mary Shelley's father really believed in science, and Mary Shelley was a bit skeptical about it. And she presented, if you know the novel, Dr. Frankenstein as someone who was driven, in a way, by this need to excel and cross these boundaries. So I'm not clear how just sort of urging people to embrace these moral concerns is going to change the outcome if what people are really driven by is this curiosity that you've said. I mean, I don't want to spend too much longer, but if either of you would like to say something about that quickly, feel free, but don't feel obliged.
I think I can speak for many scientists when I say that if someone tells you you ought to be doing something more ethical, your first reaction is to say, stay out of my way, I'm doing science. That's the first reaction. And I myself am not convinced by the argument that if you do something more ethical, you do better science. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced it'll be worse science, but I just think it's an independent dimension.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to know a few more sentences, or are you happy?
So I think often when people say you need to do better, sort of more ethical science, what they're pushing is you ought to kind of pursue socially important problems, or you ought to take a certain kind of approach. Whereas I think instead, right, what we need to recognize is that scientists are making all kinds of normative judgments. Often they're epistemic, what kind of assumptions will better lead me to the truth? But often the way in which we're, say, taking ambiguous evidence and resolving that evidence, it's a value-driven matter where we rely on values that aren't clearly just these kind of truthy values, right? When we say, well, we prefer a theory that's simpler over one that's more complex. Do we think that's necessarily because simpler theories are more true? You could try to give that kind of account, but I think it's difficult to. So I think it's helpful to recognize that scientists bring in a number of values when they're doing science, and it's not so much a matter of, like, you need to do research that's ethically important. You can't be driven in a certain direction just by your curiosity. Instead, it's a reflection on what are all of the values that you're drawing on. Let's be kind of explicit and transparent about method and open to critique about the method that you're using.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, thanks.
I want to disagree with
you. Yeah, please.
I think there's very good basis for believing that simpler theories are better. There's something called minimum description length, which it turns out is equivalent to Bayesian theorizing. And it basically says that in the limit, the simplest theory is going to be correct.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk more.
A sentence or two. You can turn to Occam's razor next, but it's kind
But Occam's razor was just a kind of claim, but there's a whole bunch of mathematics now that lies behind the idea that simpler theories are, like, for example, if you're going to play a betting game, a Bayesian will always win at a betting game. It's a proper Bayesian.
It shows and you we should do more betting.
It's equivalent to being a proper Bayesian. So.
Apparently we... Yeah, no, I've got to speak
is
more into here.
Life?
Kate, you just want to very quickly, because I want to have another round quickly and then give the audience a go.
Results depend on assumptions.
Okay, there you are. That is concise.
No.
That is even more concise.
Mathematical theorems do not depend on assumptions. It's a theorem or it's not a theorem.
Okay, now someone has to have the last word so I can ask the next question. You can't hear. Okay, can you hear now when I do this? Oh, you have to speak. I don't know, you have to yell or something, but don't... Wait till I'm
on. Can you hear this? Okay, I have to put it very close.
Terrible. Okay, now look, I've got another question and then I want to turn to the audience. So one of the central things that Geoffrey Hinton was talking about, I'll address you first of all, he listed a series of risks, and the one he spent most time talking on was, you know, really very serious risks, existential threats. Now, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago, there was a big debate in moral philosophy about genetically modified crops. And the outcome of that was to suggest that there should be a kind of precautionary principle adopted. Well, there was a debate about it. It never really got resolved. It sort of fell away a bit. But I just wanted you to reflect on, is that something that ought to be being applied here? I mean, there the issue seems to be about the extent of the effect, but also the irreversibility of the effect, which seems to be very germane here. What would you say about, is that a sort of background way of thinking about it, or is this a special case? Nuclear weapons like?
Yeah, so I think absolutely we should be kind of using our tools from decision theory in order to think through these risks. I think that, you know, we have reason to pay attention to even very small probability risks that have, you know, a high degree, you know, where the outcome would be very, very bad. At the same time, maybe we'll kind of add two elements. One, often when we face the kind of tricky thing in these situations is we're just in a case of severe uncertainty. So often we can't even describe the kind of states of the world that we're concerned about, and we can't do anything like attach precise probabilities to them. So often what the kind of precautionary principle, I think one way of taking it is a way, it's kind of encouraging us to gather more evidence before we make decisions. I think a second kind of problem is, it's a general problem for any kind of broadly consequentialist theory, is that it asks us to take, you know, kind of like future very, very bad risks with a very, very small probability very, very seriously, but in a way that we recognize that it will very, very much harm current people now. So if you took a kind of overly precautionary approach, right? So, right, Jeff mentioned AI benefits in healthcare. If you took an overly precautionary approach, we'd have to say, well, we need to kind of like, you know, stop, everybody leave the AI factory. We can't do that anymore. We can't have all these kind of benefits. And then we might recognize, well, that's overly conservative. So I think that's why we have a reason not to be too precautionary, right? And to use our kind of standard tools from decision theory in order to think through these problems. But yeah, I think it's a very helpful lens on these issues.
Did you have any thoughts about that?
No, but I have thoughts about something else I'd like to say. And it relates to what you said about jobs. And,
yeah.
So I'm less optimistic than you. I think that what's going to happen is when a lot of intellectual labor gets replaced by machines, the people who own those machines are going to get a lot richer, people like Musk, and the people who get replaced are getting a lot poorer, and so it's going to increase the gap between the rich and the poor. And I grew up in the 1950s, which was right after the Second World War. I can say something now which will reveal that I am definitely not a professor of political science. So we were taught at school that the reason for fascism in Germany in the 30s was that the Treaty of Versailles made the Germans very poor. And I believe Keynes thought that was going to happen too. So you may have noticed there's a lot of fascism resurging now. It's kind of extraordinary. I never thought I'd live to see the return of fascism. And you might ask why. What's the equivalent of the Treaty of Versailles? And I think the equivalent of the Treaty of Versailles is Clinton and Blair. So under Clinton and Blair, who were Democrat and Labour, the gap between rich and poor got bigger. It should have got smaller and it got bigger. And they were the ones who should have made it smaller. And I think that's a terrible thing. And if you look what it's done in the States, it's awful. You've got the gig economy. So I think AI is going to make that much worse. And it terrifies me.
Yeah, just to jump in, so I absolutely agree with you. So I think, you know, and this is a problem for our background institutions. So the problem is kind of governmental and economic failures that lead to, you know, as David Autor has pointed out, this kind of polarization effect that we're hollowing out these middle class, you know, middle income jobs to very, very few high income kind of upper class jobs, and everybody else is being shifted downwards. And that, you know, is very much the current trend, right? And so I think this is why, again, we all as kind of citizens in a democracy, or if not a democracy, citizens with some kind of, in a country where you might have some political influence, need to, right, demand, you know, look at the kind of, again, our background institutions that are enabling this kind of inequality. And I don't know if I'm optimistic about change or not, but in any case, it's very clear that change needs to happen, because I agree this absolutely is the trend. Yeah.
Look, thank you very much. That's a very illuminating conversation. Well, it's time now to turn over to the floor. I suspect there'll be a number of people with questions. So I just first of all need to tell you, when you ask a question, can you say who you are and where you're from and any institutional affiliation? Because we do have a large online audience as well, and it would be useful for everyone to know. I'm also going to have to take some questions from the online audience, so don't despair if it goes backwards and forwards a bit. I'm just going to take three people. If you could all be super concise, we'll get lots of questions in. So can I start with this woman here at the front? And then I will go to the gentleman with, well, there's two gentlemen with glasses in the middle there.
Okay, is it on?
Yes. Okay.
Thank
Give it
you
a go.
So much. Big honor to get the first question. My question is for Jeffrey, so I'll wait till you get a microphone. I'll give it back to you. So yeah, I'm Lily Muller. I am a postdoctoral fellow in the SCS department at Cornell and in the War Studies department at King's College. And my question is super quick. It's just to a point you made, Jeffrey, about the superintelligence and existential risk. I wrote it down to be very precise. I'm just wondering, why do you think that superintelligence will have the desire to compete or take over? So why does it have an aggressive nature? Is that because humans built it, or do you have any more experience from your time working with it?
Just hold that thought if you don't mind, yeah. just because otherwise we'll not get through all this. But just, you need a pad.
My name is Yao Ming Hui. I'm a chartered accountant by profession, but I'm very interested in AI. My question is this. Is it possible, if we do achieve AGI, is it possible to codify things to the robot? Things like, for example, Asimov's three laws of robotics, right? Mathematically and all that sort of thing. Do you envisage a situation where that could be done technically?
All right, let's stop there. Otherwise, you can't hold them all together. So, one, two.
Is my microphone working now?
What has happened to the speaker?
They took my microphone.
Okay. I think this is some kind of test of whether you get flustered. Can you just repeat the last thing you said? Oh, okay, good. So I think that will certainly happen if they start competing with each other. If evolution kicks in, then even if one just has a tiny bit of tendency to preserve itself, that one will do better. And so if evolution kicks in, I think it'll happen. Without evolution, I think it may happen because they'll create sub-goals for themselves, and a very obvious sub-goal is get more control.
Can you say in one sentence your question?
Say.
Can you codify?
No, you can't. So, for example, if you look at one of those laws, probably the first one, which is don't hurt humans. Okay, one of the main funders of this is defense departments building battle robots. I don't think that one's going to be in there. Then there's the problem of the alignment problem, which is it's very hard to predict the consequences of asking it to do something, particularly if it's much smarter than you. But a classic example would be, you ask it to see if you can slow down climate change. Now, if you're not too careful, the obvious way to do that is just get rid of people.
Okay, I'm going to take a question from the online audience. This is from Deborah Dean in Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. I'll put it to you in the first instance. Assuming that generative AI depends on the cumulative sources available digitally to learn from, isn't it just stealing analog sources from people who have contributed to the sum total of knowledge? Do you think they should be paid for their contributions? This obviously is an issue that's currently being considered in various courts and so on. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think... time to revisit the moral foundations of intellectual property law. A lot of them are around incentivizing companies to kind of produce goods and services that we all want because they get rewarded for taking on those risky operations. In this case, right, it seems like we might get a lot of social benefit through open sourcing of data and sharing of data, in which case we just have reason to do that. Second, there's been a big kind of data is labor movement. I think that we might have a number of worries about that. We might think, well, people who have very few kind of options for good paid work might be pushed into doing this kind of data is labor. I think there are a number of kind of concerns that we might have about that. But it is clear that a small number of companies are profiting from the kind of information that's freely available on the internet, but I'm not sure that that should lead us to think we should make information less available or usable for scientific and commercial enterprise, nor I think should we automatically jump to, well, thereby we should kind of pay people for their particular acts of generating data.
Okay, so let's have some more questions.
I'd just like to say, yes, I think please. That was a perfect answer.
We'll get back to the Bayesian stuff later.
Now let's have some concord. So the person with the pale hair and the... Yes, this woman here, I think.
Hello, thank you so much for your talk. I'm Anna, master's student in management here at the LSE. We talked a bit about democratic control over AI, so I would like to hear your thoughts on the EU AI Act and sort of how legislations of its kind should look like to control the risks we talked about.
Okay, so I think the panel wants to do them one by one, so let's just start with one by one, but we might have to go back to taking a few at the end or people won't have a go. So was that directed at...
EU AI Act?
I'll tell you, when I want to find out what's in the Act, I ask GPT-4.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot good there, right? I think we might have two concerns. One is that, right, we're in this kind of problem where we need, like, truly global regulation. There are some outsized players who are having a say in the kind of regulation. Second problem, big companies like Google, Microsoft are better able to comply with this regulation that might kind of, especially globally, right, a lot of smaller companies, startup ventures might not be able to comply with it. So I think we need to be kind of careful about who just, you know, having a number of players on the table and thinking about compliance and compliance issues. But I cannot, leave it there.
Okay, now there's a fellow with a brown leather jacket. Yes, you. Yeah.
Thank you. So I'm John Cardoso Silva, an assistant professor of data science here at LSE. I think I share the views of my colleague Kate more than Geoffrey's, I believe. But Geoffrey Hinton, so my question for you is the following. So I understand, though I don't agree, when you say that machines like deep learning, they reason. I can see how that happens. But when you say that they can have desire or they do have the desire to do something, I don't see where these mechanism is in the deep learning architecture or the machines themselves. Where is the mechanism for desire in the architectures we have?
Okay, suppose I have a battle robot and it tries to kill me. That is, it creeps up behind me when I'm not looking and tries to shoot me and soft spots. I think it would be perfectly reasonable to say that has the desire to kill me. If you look at AlphaGo, AlphaGo wants to win. I think many people, including myself sometimes, are inclined to think of these sort of internal essences that desire some kind of internal essence. I think it's just these things have goals. They try and achieve those goals. That is desire.
Okay, the gentleman in white here at the front, if just wait till the thing comes and say who you are and where you're from and so on.
Hello, so my name, thank you, Professor Hinson. My name is Barry. I'm here as an independent in my personal capacity, but my background
is... Interested citizen.
Yes, I'm a citizen. I've got a background in psychology and physiology, but... So it's along the lines of the same question, really. So animals care about things and people care about things, but outside of human programming, saying this is your goal, can you imagine, if you park for one moment this idea of self-preservation, can you imagine something in the lifetime of a model which a desire? What other things will models actually come to care about? Can you imagine anything that they'll come to care about by themselves, in and of themselves?
Well, obviously, if they start evolving, that is, if they start competitively evolving, they will care about all sorts of things. They'll care about helping their offspring. They'll care about getting rid of people, other beings that are challenging them for resources. I think that's all going to come if they evolve, as it did with us. I mean, if you ask where did it come from in us, it came from evolution, I think. So from evolution it could come. But I also think they can arrive at these things just by reasoning too. So if they want to achieve something, they can create sub-goals. And once they've got those sub-goals, those act like desires, right? They want to achieve those sub-goals.
Okay. Yes, let's have this person over here. Just wait, yeah.
Thank you both. I'd like to come back to that first exchange, and I should say I'm Julia Haas, but I'm also here in a private capacity. So I'd like to come back to that first exchange about science and curiosity and values. And I'd like you to imagine two scientific studies. The first study studies or examines risks for cardiovascular disease in men between the ages of 18 and 85. The second study examines risk factors for cardiovascular disease in men and women between the ages of 18 and 85, where women's menstrual cycles modulate cardiovascular function and therefore make the findings much more complex and harder to interpret. Which one of those is better science, and which one of those addresses our curiosity more when it comes to understanding something like heart function?
I know what the wrong answer is, Shane. I can imagine a statistician saying he'd much rather analyze the first one. But I think you learn much more from the second one. It's just complicated.
And that's what we did, right, for decades and decades and decades. Yeah. Even today, women are underrepresented. So I think, just to say, to come back to the point, I think there's lots of ways of coming back to these questions of value in science, but it's a matter of where we interpret them or something like that. And the question is, how much space do we want to give them in AI as a science or something like that? It's a cheap shot.
Did you want to comment on that too, Kate? Or?
No.
Okay, gosh, there are 101 people we're going to have trouble, but people are being super concise, which is very good for everyone else. The person with the purple shirt.
Hi, I'm Lennon. I'm just a bloke. And this one's more at Jeff. So your talk seemed to be built on the assumption that the usurpation of digital intelligence should be prevented due to superior moral worth of humans. But given that you claim that AIs can have conscious experience, do you believe that we will always be morally superior? And could you sort of discuss your underlying philosophical stances that get you there?
It's a very good question. I try and avoid the issue of political rights for AIs, because it's a very contentious issue that will lose. Most people will think they shouldn't have rights. If you look historically, it took a lot of violence and a lot of time for people whose skin was a different color to get rights. It then took some violence and a lot of time for people whose genitalia were different to get rights. If you think how different these machines are, the conclusion would be, if they really want to get rights, it's going to be extremely violent and extremely nasty. So I prefer not to talk about that.
Yeah, and I guess, right, just to build on that, so we wouldn't want to be kind of anthropocentric in our granting of moral status, but we notice, right, that we tend to privilege our own species. We treat animals horrifically. There's probably not a kind of good moral justification for the various treatments that we give them. But then a second thing I wanted to point out, so it's important to distinguish between the moral duties that you have to a sentient creature once they exist and whether or not we have moral duties to bring about those sentient creatures. So you might say, well, we might have moral duties to the sentient creatures if they exist, but it's not privileging humans in order to say we don't now have moral duties to those non-existent sentient creatures, and we don't have a moral obligation to bring them about, and maybe it's not even morally permissible. So I just want to distinguish those two questions, and given that we're in the stage, right, where those creatures don't exist, we can productively ask the kind of moral questions without assuming anything about the kind of superiority of human beings.
I also think that we're people. What we care about is people. We don't care about them. And we should treat them like we treat animals. That's my gut feeling. Okay. We may not be able to get away with it.
Right, I'm going to take a question from the online audience. This is from Emma Wang, who is a second year undergraduate in social policy. It's quite a short question. I'll start with you. Do you think the use of AI will exacerbate or mitigate educational inequality? You were talking about inequality like the attainment gap, but among the global South countries.
Could do either, but I'm pessimistic, just as with jobs.
I think I'm the opposite, I think. I taught one of the first Coursera courses precisely for that reason, mm-hmm. because you didn't have to be able to pay to go to a fancy university to take the course. Mm-hmm. I think with AI we're going to get extremely good personal tutors. It won't come for a while. And the rich have always had access to good personal tutors. And I'm remembering some paper, you learn about twice as fast if you have a good personal tutor as if you're in a classroom. And I don't see why we shouldn't have very good personal tutors for everybody if we can make this stuff cheap enough. There's something that relates to jobs too that is very relevant to this. There's some kinds of jobs where if an AI does the job, you replace the people and that's it. There's other kinds of jobs which are kind of infinitely elastic. So medicine's like that. If I could have 15 doctors working on the problem of this funny lump on my cheek, I would have 15 doctors working on it. There's no end to how much medical expertise I could consume. So one has to distinguish when one talks about AI getting rid of jobs, what kind of job it is, whether it's something where the demand can just go up indefinitely. And for tutoring, I think the demand can go up enormously, right?
Yeah.
Right, so let me take another question. I'm going to start with the person with the purple jumper, and then I'm going to go to the woman with the glasses two-thirds of the way down.
My name's David Wood from London Futurist. My question's about open source and AI, because Professor Hinton, you raised a very important point that it may be very dangerous to allow anybody to experiment with open source AI, because they'll often not be inclined to follow the health and safety rules or the political correctness rules or whatever. But it seems we're not getting any convergence on this. We've got people from Meta and Elon Musk, as you were saying, they're not just saying, well, it might be dangerous, but on balance, it's all right. They're being evangelical and saying, absolutely, we must release this. So my question is, do you see any possibility of a convergence, an agreement amongst the powers that be on this? From your meetings in Bletchley Park or recently in Beijing or maybe in a couple of months' time in Seoul, will there be a convergence that we're going to have to be careful with open source as well?
I think we can get convergence when Jan realizes that he's wrong.
Why doesn't he realize it?
Part of it is he works for Facebook. And he's of the belief that the good guys will always have more resources than the bad guys. And the thing to keep bad AI under control is good AI. But we don't necessarily agree on who the good guys are. Jan thinks Mark Zuckerberg's a good guy.
Okay. Where is that person who... Yeah, there. Wave your arm around so they can see.
Thank you. My name is Carla, and I'm a student in the Media and Communications Department, postgrad student. And I was wondering if, when we're talking about LLMs and generative AI and hallucinations, if there's like the knowledge it produces and the information it's generating, is there a limit to it or is it infinite? Like the limit being the algorithmic biases or the algorithms that generate this information? Or could this be ad infinitum of knowledge, but then the risk of fake information being created, how big is that risk?
I'm not sure I understood the question. Can I try and refine the question?
Yes.
Your question, if we made these networks bigger and bigger, would they just keep getting more and more knowledge?
Yeah. Like the main point of my question is like the risk of hallucinations and how infinite the knowledge it creates or generates can be and the potential harm behind it, because it's based on algorithms. So how...
Well, remember, these things aren't based on an algorithm. That is, as a learning algorithm, there's a way of taking the data and deciding how to change the strengths of connections between neurons. Things are a bit more complicated than that. That's an algorithm. That's somebody programmed that, and that's how it learns. But what it learns depends on how that algorithm interacts with a lot of data. And once it's learned, it's just a bunch of features and interactions between features. That's not an algorithm. That's like a person with intuition. And it does hallucinate. So do we. So most people are unaware of just how much we hallucinate. Just one example of that. If you take John Dean, who testified at Watergate, he testified under oath before he knew there were tapes. And it could have been very embarrassing for him. And in fact, a lot of what he said was just plain wrong. He said this person said that, and that person said this, and these people were in this meeting. All of that, a lot of that was just wrong. But the gist of what he said was correct. What was going on in the White House, he conveyed that very well. And what he was doing was, he was making up stories that captured the gist. And that's what we do when we have memories too. If you have memories of something very recent, you make up a story that's probably true. If you have memories of something a long time ago, you make up a story that will have all sorts of details that aren't right. But you don't know which ones are right. You're as attached to the details that are wrong as you are to the ones that are right. We're just like these things, and people think somehow we're not.
Okay, I'm going to take one more question from here, then I'm going to go to the online audience again. It's, I think, a woman with a blue top on. Have you got a coat or something? Yeah, just wave your arm around. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Lara. I'm a master's student of cyber policy at KCL. And my question is, refers to a previous one, but I think it's worth asking anyway. So I think for a lot of people it's fairly unintuitive how a potential superintelligence could get from an overall goal, so a task we may give it or whatever, to a sub-goal or an instrumental goal. And especially how we can predict what those instrumental goals might be before we see a scenario like this play out. So I would love to hear maybe an elaboration of that specific scenario.
That's called the alignment problem, right? The alignment problem is, if you give it a goal, do you know that the way it achieves that goal will align with human values? It's a very difficult problem. Lots of people are working on it. One of the difficulties of that problem is not just predicting what sub-goals it'll come up with, but if you want them to align with human values, that's sort of making an assumption that there's one thing called human values. So there isn't one thing called human values. Some people think it's okay to drop 2,000-pound bombs on children, and other people don't think that. So how are you going to align with that?
Right. Did you want to comment? You happy? I'm going to take a question from from the online audience. This is from Zhengzi Zhang, who is a student here at the LSE in political sociology. So there you are. Now, you said, Kate, that there was the potential for political power to be more egalitarian in its distribution. This question has some bearing on that. Will artificial intelligence replace the role of the expert in bureaucratic systems? Will it cause further development of a technocratic state? It's a very nice, concise question.
So to say, again, I'm not a sociologist, so I'm just going to say I think the kind of answer to these questions is just going to depend on the shape of our kind of background institutions, whether or not I agree that, say, AI has like a huge promise for personalized tutoring and education, and it's just going to depend on these questions of, do we have the kind of background internet infrastructure? Do people have devices? Is it in a language that they can understand? Is it kind of tailored to social norms that will help with personalized tutoring? So we might say there's a kind of huge potential, right, for things to go either way, and it's going to depend, and just a kind of pitch for the LSE, right? The answer to all of these questions will depend on doing a lot of hard social science, and understanding, well, given the shape of this particular bureaucracy in a particular country, given what its institutions are like, what do we think is likely to happen?
So I have one comment about that is,
please, yeah.
We probably all remember how Facebook caused the Arab Spring, but that was very short-lived. And pretty soon, governments were using surveillance and AI to control people, and that was a much bigger effect than the Arab Spring effect.
Which would have been an interesting discussion to have between you earlier, it occurred to me. The fact that you had to remove the two people from your presentation is relevant in itself. I'm just going to very quickly, if you can just make three super quick questions and you just choose which ones to answer, because we've got to stop fairly soon. So the fellow here with the glasses and the pale striped shirt, and then who have we got over here? Someone who's sort of... Peace. Yes, you. And then we'll take someone at the back who I haven't worked out yet.
Hi, I'm Victor Vadano. I'm a business person. I have a question about creativity. You said AI, humans are arrogant about what AI can do, cannot do. If you look at history in musicians, at authors, in literature, in art, there have been people who have done breakthrough things that have completely changed the face of the art or whatever. You talk about Bach or so many people.
Not too many examples, yeah. It's
kind of funny. When you look at Beethoven's 10th Symphony, which was created by AI, it's bland. It's not Beethoven. I mean, it sounds like Beethoven, but it's nothing emotional about it. There's no emotion being conveyed. Can AI do creativity that actually moves us?
Okay, hold that thought, Beethoven, and then we've got...
No, I don't like this. We should answer the questions when they come.
Well, we're going to have to stop in about 2 minutes. So.
Yeah, but it doesn't make any difference.
Okay, off you go. It depends how concise you are in your answer.
So, my answer to that is move 37. If you look at AlphaGo, that was a highly creative move that professional Go players had never thought of and were astounded by. I don't see why that shouldn't happen in all sorts of other domains when you get something that's as much better than us as AlphaGo was than the average Go player.
Creativity is about problem solving. AI is great at solving problems.
Thank you very much.
Is it working? Yeah. So my name is Reggie. I'm head of governance and strategy in a financial institution. And my question goes because Jeffrey, you mentioned some of your pessimism related to the development of AI. And my question would be, what kind of policies would be necessary that we can actually profit from the incredible productive gains of AI and actually use it to reduce inequality in the world? What kind of system, what kind of policies would need to be in place that we can profit from it?
I can give a very short answer. Socialism.
Well, nothing to add to that.
This being the Ralph Miliband program, I think that is an excellent point on which to stop. Look, thank you. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you to our online audience. I particularly want to thank our two speakers who've taken us through a wide range of issues of serious risks, potentially very serious risks, also some thoughts about how we should think about it, what we might do to get the steering wheel in our hands again. So can you join me once again in thanking our speakers, Professor Jeffrey and Dr. Patrick.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.